Welcome to today's program titled 2017 National Year in Review, what you need to know about the recent cases and developments in trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud law. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you're encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert. Robert, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you to the audience for attending today's webinar. Let me introduce you briefly to our panel. We have Michael Wexler, who's the chair of our Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud group. He's based in Chicago, Illinois. He's also the head of our litigation department in the Chicago office, also joined by senior associate Joshua Salinas. He's resident in our Century City, California office. And then myself, I'm the co-chair of our National Trade Secrets Non-Compete Computer Fraud group. Again, thanks so much for joining us today. We've been doing this National Year in Review for a number of years now, and it's always a pleasure to get together with an audience that share similar interests. What we try to do in this hour presentation is highlight some of the main developments and areas of consideration and development that we've seen over the past year so that you can be prepared as an employer to meet the challenges in this trade secret non-compete space. As you see on your screen, there's a number of topics that we'd like to cover in this presentation. I'm going to briefly go over some new trade secret cases and also discuss some notable Defend Trade Secret Act cases with highlighting some emerging issues and trends. Michael and Josh are going to get into some of the state legislation regarding restrictive covenants, some new restrictive covenant cases. Michael's going to focus on some latest decisions on forum selection clauses, and Josh is going to get into some ongoing social media and solicitation issues, as well as some notable computer fraud law developments and cases. And then finally, we're going to conclude the presentation with a discussion of the ABA ethics opinion on protecting client information. At any time, feel free to ask a question on the online display, and we'll try to get to your question during the presentation or follow up at a later time. With that, why don't we go ahead and jump into today's presentation. When we talk about some new trade secret cases, I think one case that's obviously captivated a lot of people's attention in the Silicon Valley as well as the nation as it relates to trade secrets is the Waymo versus Uber case that's currently set for trial in February of this year in the Northern District of California. In a nutshell, you know, the case involves a former Google engineer who left Google and joined Uber. And in particular, technology at issue is the self-driving car technology. It was obviously something that the employee had worked on at Google, and he's alleged of taking some 14,000 files and taking them over to Uber. There's disputed issues in the case regarding whether those files were actually used by Uber and the extent to which the former employee used the files. But there's been a number of fascinating issues. It's there's big law firms on both sides, and it seems like almost all the all the issues are disputed, and so you get a lot of decisions. Both from the magistrate judge, the special master appointed in the case, as well as the federal district judge. There's been interesting issues with respect to the attorney-client privilege. One of the issues that came up, something that comes up often with in-house counsel, is when the CEO and the employee are in the same room, and in-house counsel is interviewing and asking information about what the facts, whether that particular conversation would be subject to the attorney-client privilege. In that particular instance, the court found that, of course, it was subject to the attorney-client privilege. Uber took the interesting position of indicating that they wanted to waive the privilege. The specific testimony that was at issue is that the employee was disclosing as far as why he took the particular documents, and that he claimed that he took the documents because he wanted to have the documents to justify his bonus. And so what the court found there was, well, you're trying to use that information offensively to show that there was no wrongdoing. And the court found that there was a subject matter waiver beyond that specific communication as to all communications related to that topic. And so it was, you know, very interesting issue, very significant as it relates to conducting in-house counsel and investigations. Also, very fascinating Fifth Amendment issues. In this particular case, the employee asserted the Fifth Amendment to efforts to take his deposition, to respond to discovery. And the judge in the case made an interesting order that basically ordered Uber to terminate the employee if the employee would not cooperate in turning over the documentation that he allegedly stole to Waymo. And so there was a forced compulsion of the termination of his employment for not complying with the court's order, which also was, you know, quite fascinating. Another real interesting issue in the case is the injunctive relief that was issued in the case. This was an instance where the judge issued an order enjoining Uber from using the employee on the self-driving technology. And so I think if you step back from that, you know, a lot of attorneys and in-house counsel, when they think of California, apart from other not so nice things they may say about California, they often know that it's a jurisdiction where non-competes are very difficult to enforce. And to get a restriction on this former employee that he couldn't work in the self-driving technology space is a real eye-opener. Because most people think, oh yeah, you can go join a competitor, so long as you're not using trade secrets, you can pretty much do whatever you want. But for a court to issue affirmative relief preventing him from working there is a good example that if you do have evidence showing the taking of confidential documents, that even in California you can get relief and competitive restriction on former employees' activities. One of the other issues that came up in this case is the scope of trade secret preemption. And not to get too off in the weeds and nuanced, but I think it's significant because in California, and you know, it's something that separates it from the rest of the country, is there's this notion, at least among some of the judges in California, that if you're talking about the protection of information, that the information needs to rise to the level of a trade secret in order for it to be protectable. And that challenges people at their core when you start thinking about, you know, non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements. Are you telling me that if my information is not a trade secret, that it wouldn't be protectable under a non-disclosure agreement? Well, some courts have gotten so far as to say that in California. I don't necessarily agree that that's an accurate statement of the law, but there's a lot of dispute with respect to the protection of information. And whether it does need to rise to the level of a trade secret. Now, in this particular case, there were some companion claims that went along with the trade secret claim, such as unfair competition, and the court found that those particular claims were preempted. And then finally, a word to the wise in this particular case, there's been several companion cases here. There's been an arbitration between the employee and Waymo, and there's also been a case brought by the former employee's nanny against the employee for wage claims. The reason that it's significant is that in the nanny's complaint, which is denied by the employee, There's interesting details about the employee allegedly wanting to flee to Canada and validating, you know, communications that occurred, you know, vis-a-vis the CEO of Uber and the Waymo, former Waymo executive. But it's getting ready to go to trial in February. It's captivating, you know, the legal journalists that are following it, and I'm sure that we're going to see a lot of more activity coming out of that case. Another significant case also in the Ninth Circuit was the United States versus Liu decision. And I think if you step back, you know, the word to the wise on this particular decision is that employers often forget to use non-disclosure agreements, not just with their employees, but with other vendors, third-party partners that may get exposure, you know, to the trade secret. So they may ask for a non-disclosure agreement with an employee, but they may provide that same information to a contractor or a business partner and may not have the same level of agreements in place. And that can be problematic, and, you know, it doesn't mean that it's going to be dispositive, but it's something that, as far as best practices that, you know, having the three of us having done these cases, it's something that can really help the company in its position. Anyway, the upshot of this case is it was a criminal decision, and the Ninth Circuit upheld the criminal conviction against Mr. Liu for violating the Economic Espionage Act. Now, Mr. Liu argued that since a third-party competitor who was not bound by any confidentiality obligations had acquired the trade secret as part of an acquisition, that there that destroyed any secrecy in the alleged trade secret, and that it was plain error at the trial court level for the district court not to instruct the jury that disclosure to even a single recipient who is not bound by a legal obligation to maintain the trade secret secrecy destroys the trade secret protection. And the Ninth Circuit found that it was not, you know, it was not plain error, that the court did not need to provide that jury instruction. And so the upshot was that, yes, you could disclose a trade secret to a single recipient who would not be bound by an NDA, and you could still have a trade secret. But again, it's something where you're really playing with fire if you don't have such agreements or policies in place. And what you'll see on the screen is that this particular criminal decision was decided before the passage of the Federal Defend Trade Secrets Act in 2016. And the language that the criminal defendant was really focusing on is the highlighted language, the public. And so the argument was, well, it couldn't be a trade secret because it was not it was generally known by the public when it was disclosed to that single recipient. Now, after the passage of the Defend Trade Secret Act, that language has been modified from public to by other persons who might obtain economic value. So you can see that under this new language, the defendant may be in a stronger position because certainly a competitor would be someone who would qualify by as other persons who might obtain economic value. Another significant decision that came out in 2017 highlights the concept that even if your trade secret claim, you know, fails or it's not the strongest claim, that if you do have a breach of a non-disclosure agreement, that non-disclosure agreement claim can be quite valuable. Taking back what, you know, I said as far as in California, you know, putting that aside, in other jurisdictions, I think it's, you know, very well established that non-disclosure breach of contract claims for the disclosure of confidential information are actionable and there's not problems, you know, so long as you can show the information is protectable. And this is what this federal decision in Texas demonstrates. While there was no liability on the trade secret claim, there was a very large verdict in tens of millions of dollars on the breach of the non-disclosure agreement. And you could see in the jury charge, it was they opened up the floodgates. The jury was asked, you know, what sum of money would fairly and reasonably compensate the plaintiffs for their injuries that resulted from the defendant's failure to comply with the non-disclosure agreement. And so the tip here is that, you know, properly drafted non-disclosure agreements in business transactions, as well as in the employment relationship, can go a long way towards satisfying the reasonable measures standard. And by that, I mean that's built into the definition of a trade secret. In order for a trade secret to be protectable, there needs to be a showing that the information was protected by reasonable secrecy measures. And so certainly an NDA would be a way of showing that. But also, you can help it can help fortify your claims against a departing employee or business partner by creating a binding enforceable contract that can provide, you know, consequential damages if there's a breach. And even in those jurisdictions that have a strong doctrine of trade secret preemption, which may sweep aside tort claims such as tortious interference with contract, you know, unfair competition, even in those jurisdictions, it's plainly well established that you could still have a breach of contract claim. And so that's something to keep in consideration, and to also be mindful of that when you're rolling out, you know, new agreements with employees and contractors. Another decision we wanted to highlight for you was a 2017 Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. And I think the main takeaway on this decision is that the court, you know, found, and it was interesting because it's a summary judgment case, the court found that the plaintiff had failed to present sufficient evidence of misappropriation or conspiracy to proceed beyond the summary judgment stage. And at least, you know, at least in Wisconsin, you know, the parties are on notice of the importance of finding direct evidence of misappropriation in defeating a motion for summary judgment. You know, oftentimes it's difficult to find direct evidence of misappropriation, either because the plaintiff doesn't have the access to the discovery, or the defendants have destroyed the evidence, or been less than forthcoming, or hiding the box and not showing their cards. And so this is actually a very pro-defendant decision because it doesn't, I don't think, adequately take into account, you know, the use of circumstantial evidence in establishing trade secret misappropriation. And, of course, that's something that the dissent in the decision pointed to. And that's why I think it's important. We've highlighted that when you have these trade secret decisions, you know, expedited discovery or prompt discovery at the time of the claim is filed, and really developing whether there's adequate preservation that's been done, whether there's been any spoliation of the case, of the evidence in the case, is key to understand at the inception, so you can be able to determine whether you're going to be able to move for summary judgment or whether there's really not a lot of evidence of actual misappropriation, and whether you're going to have to relate to a circumstantial evidence of showing of misappropriation. Just wanted to briefly highlight some notable Defend Trade Secret Act decisions and some emerging issues and trends. Now, the Defend Trade Secrets Act has been on the books since 2016, creates a federal cause of action for trade secret misappropriation. And so I think Michael, Josh, and myself have seen more and more trade secret cases, more and more trade secret cases being brought in federal court. Some of the case law that we've been seeing in here on these particular DTSA cases may not have a long shelf life because they kind of deal with when the statute was passed and whether acts that occurred prior to the statute being passed can be actionable. And this first decision has to deal with pleading challenges that we're seeing that the DTSA requires that trade secrets are related to a product or service used or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. So it has that commerce clause tether in order to maintain a trade secret claim in federal court. So satisfying that Commerce Clause requirement, this interstate commerce, is often not a difficult obstacle in order to be in federal court. But we actually have seen some decisions where the court has dismissed the case. So if the trade secret, if it's a business that's purely local, doesn't do interstate business, and the trade secret at issue has no relation to any type of interstate commerce, then you're going to have to maintain that case in state court. But I venture to say that that situation is going to be very rare, particularly in today's interconnected economy and global economy. But at least this decision in Delaware in January of 2017, the court pointed out that there was no nexus between interstate or foreign commerce and the applicable trade secrets or agreements that were in at issue, and that the complaint didn't allege any facts after May 11, 2016, other than a conclusory allegation of continuing use and disclosure. And of course, May 11, 2016, that's the key date, because that's when the DTSA went into effect. Following up on this notion of what happens in the situation where the acquisition and misappropriation occurred before the Defend Trade Secret Act was passed, and whether or not that's actionable, and what happens in those situations where the acquisition may have occurred, but the use did not occur until after the act was in effect, and whether you can avail yourself of using the Defend Trade Secret Act. We've seen more decisions coming out on that topic. In a nutshell, there is a mix of decisions, and there's somewhat of a split in decisions. There's some decisions that say, well, if the acquisition occurred before the act was passed and the use continues, so the use continued before the act was passed, and the use continued after the act was in effect, that you can maintain a DTSA claim for that continued use. There's other decisions that say no, that if all you have is continued use after the act was in effect, since the acquisition and the first disclosure, the wrongful disclosure, occurred before the act was passed, then you're limited to suing under the state misappropriation statute. And so the cases have been going both ways. They've been much more circumspect in California, where they haven't been more willing to use the continuing misappropriation doctrine that's been developed in some of these earlier decisions. In fact, in this Avago Technologies case, they dismissed the DTSA claims because the trade secrets were disclosed before the DTSA Act came into effect, and the fact that there could be continuing misappropriation was not persuasive to the court to allow the claim to proceed. One of the greatest benefits that separates the Defend Trade Secrets Act from the state misappropriation statutes is this remedy, this extraordinary remedy of an ex parte seizure. And what that means is that you could file a lawsuit, get a court order, and have a federal marshal show up at the defendant's business and seize the alleged misappropriated items and obtain some of the evidence that would help support those claims before the defendant was even served with the lawsuit. So it's quite an extraordinary remedy. It's something that separates it from the state statutes and other remedies that are available in this realm. But what we've seen is that there's been only a handful of courts that have actually been willing to issue that ex parte seizure order. Most courts have found that it's unnecessary, and that Rule 65, which is the injunction rule, is already a sufficient rule to provide an appropriate remedy to preserve evidence and to provide injunctive relief. So we've provided you with some of the decisions where the court hasn't been willing to provide for the ex parte seizure order. Briefly, and I want to swing this over back over to Josh and Michael, one of the issues that's come up under the Defend Trade Secrets Act is whether you can obtain an inevitable disclosure injunction. the scenario where you have a key executive who joins a direct competitor and is going to be working in the same space, and then going to the court and say, well, listen, that person's going to have to be using our trade secrets and I need an injunction. Now, I think when you look at the legislative history, there was somewhat of an intent to try to not allow those type of injunctions, and the statute itself, you know, provides language that the DTSA may not prevent a person from entering into an employment relationship, but at the same time it provides that clear language. It comes back and says, but the court can issue an order putting conditions on the former employee's employment based upon evidence of threatened misappropriation and not merely on the information the person knows. So we have seen some injunctions under the DTSA which could be construed as inevitable disclosure injunctions. But the key language is if you can show threatened misappropriation, then you're going to be able to put some conditions on that employment. A great example is going to be the Uber case where the employee at issue, he was not permitted to work in the self-driving technology. Now, query whether he could still work for Uber in a different capacity, but the main reason they hired him for, he was not able to work for them. There was an injunction issued on that basis. So I think we'll see more and more decisions on inevitable disclosure and how it relates to the DTSA statutory language. And then lastly, one thing that comes up in trade secret litigation occasionally is where the former employee takes a whole bunch of documents and gives them to their attorney and then purports to be a whistleblower. Sometimes those are justified, sometimes they're not. Oftentimes the company is troubled, particularly if the information at issue really isn't whistleblower information, but maybe information that's confidential, trade secret type information. What this decision on your screen, the Unum case, found is that it's going to be an affirmative defense for the employee that takes trade secrets in that scenario to show that they are covered by the whistleblower immunity that's found in the Defend Trade Secret Act, that they're not just going to be able to file a motion to dismiss and say, wait a second, I took those documents because I believe I'm a whistleblower, I believe the company was engaged in wrongdoing, and that's why I took the documents. The court wasn't buying that, basically said that's an affirmative defense, more subject to a summary judgment motion if you can make that showing. And so then finally, as most of you are aware, the Defend Trade Secret Act has a whistleblower immunity protection, and companies are encouraged to include that whistleblower immunity language in their non-disclosure agreements with their employees, contractors, consultants, and the benefit of including that whistleblower immunity language is that if you were to bring a Defend Trade Secret Act claim, you would be entitled to exemplary damages as well as to your attorney's fees. And so that would be one of the recommendations, that to the extent that you haven't added that language to your agreement, make sure you update your non-disclosure agreements to include that type of language. We will be releasing a guide. We previously released a guide. We've updated it to highlight some of these key issues. It should be coming out in February, so be sure to get up onto our mailing list and you'll receive this new guide. With that, it's my pleasure to turn the presentation over to Michael on restrictive covenant law developments.
Thanks, Robert. Interesting stuff for the DTSA. We're going to focus now on some specific state developments that may interest you depending on what state you're in or where you have offices for your particular company. So for example, turning to our first slide here, there have been some changes in Nevada. And with regard to Nevada, basically they revised their statute midway through 2017 and added some new requirements when it comes to consideration with regard to implementing restrictive covenants. As we know, and you'll hear a little bit about, different states require different consideration for non-compete. Some employment, some could be money, could be profit sharing, could be shares, RSUs, could be other consideration, sometimes training, vacation time. There's various different ways by state with regard to consideration. But The whole purpose here in Nevada is to add a new requirement regarding the consideration, and the consideration is tied to the types of restrictions also that you're using, such as prohibiting former employees from providing services soliciting your customers. It also has language that addresses enforcement in with regard to certain situations where there is a RIF, a reduction, those sorts of things, and the effect that it has on that. Where for example, some states will say that if you terminate someone without cause, you can't then enforce a non-compete against them. So Nevada has made some changes to deal with these situations, and also has permitted blue penciling, which allows for revisions of non-compete agreements when you're in an enforcement situation in court. Oregon has decided that with regard to home care workers, non-competition and non-solicitation covenants are void and unenforceable. And as you may recall in prior presentations, or if you have knowledge of Oregon law, Oregon also has restrictions with regard to, I'll say, lower paid employees and how they're dealt with when it comes to non-competes. West Virginia in the past year has placed some limits on non-competes, for example, with physicians, and has limited them to 1 year and 30 road miles from their primary practice area, so that there can be a non-compete for a doctor, whereas there are a number of states that will not permit non-competes for doctors under the premise that folks should have the right to work with their doctor no matter where they are and have that continuity of care. And of course, if you look at the second bullet point, there are some exemptions where the physicians are shareholders or owners in a healthcare practice. Pennsylvania and New Jersey, attempts are being made. There are bills that have been introduced that would limit the scope, would limit a business's ability to have employees enter into non-competes, to enforce those non-competes. Query whether those will pass, but as you may recall, there are some states that have, over the past couple of years, enacted legislation to curtail, to limit how far non-competes can go as to the types of employees and types of restrictions. So this is something that remains to be seen, but whether they can pass or not, it's possible. So we'll just leave the possibilities out there, but it's probably going to be very difficult. Businesses obviously have strong lobbies and are interested in the course of protecting, protecting customer relationships, protecting employees, et cetera. Something else to be familiar with is a brand new decision just came down, so hot off the presses. Wisconsin Supreme Court issued an opinion the other day, essentially saying that the Wisconsin statute that addresses non-competes and addresses what we'll call non-solicitation of customers actually can also apply to the solicitation of employees. There's never been a case in Wisconsin that has specifically done that. And essentially, you can see the facts in front of you, but there's a two-year non-solicit of employee provision, and there's a question about whether the person had violated it. And of course, one of the issues was the actual restriction enforceable, or was it unreasonable and an illegal restraint? And what the Supreme Court ultimately found was that it was unenforceable, and it was unenforceable for a couple reasons. One of which is that the Wisconsin statute on this and case law applies, but also that it was a general restriction. It basically said you couldn't solicit any employee, and in this case they had 13,000 worldwide employees. And with regard to the actual employee. In this fact pattern, there was no specific relationship between the employee that was solicited and the employee over which the claims were brought. So what that leads us to is a development that in Wisconsin, if you are using a specific agreement in Wisconsin, you should consider having language that ties the employee that signed the agreement to the solicitation in some way, such as they're soliciting employees that possess confidential information. It's someone that they directly or indirectly had contact with. You don't want it to apply to all employees, and you want it to apply to employees that there's a protectable interest and to employees that the person that left that would have had contact with in some fashion. And that is a possible solution to the application of Wisconsin law under the Supreme Court case. Another area to certainly be familiar with is no poaching agreements, and the class actions continue. And if you've paid attention in the news recently, the Justice Department is going to announce with greater detail that they will be policing this area of no poaching agreements between companies. And as you may recall, some of you, and we've commented on this before, that there was a few years ago, the Justice Department went after some Silicon Valley companies because they had agreed amongst themselves not to hire, not to poach each other's employees. The Justice Department found that to be an antitrust situation. They brought charges against these companies. Ultimately, those were all resolved, but it also then created, in that particular case, a class action, the high-tech employees class action lawsuit, where crafty plaintiff's attorneys brought claims on behalf of essentially high-tech employees who, according to their lawsuit, their salaries and economic opportunities were being suppressed because of these agreements between companies, et cetera. And so that will continue on, and as you will hear in the news shortly, and may have heard a little bit about it, the Justice Department is going to be really going after this area. And we will, in the next couple days, actually, we will be sending out a management alert to everyone on this particular development, and we'll also have on our website at tradesecretslaw.com a piece that we'll comment on and explain this area, because it's something that everyone should definitely be aware of, as well as what I'll call the safe harbors. For example, if there's a lawsuit between companies and it involves non-competes and non-solicits, that may be an area in which companies, of course, can just settle the case, make certain agreements, because the case was based on some of that conduct in the first place. You can certainly check that out on our website. If you're on our mailing list, you'll receive that information as well. As you may know, in Illinois, the Fifield decision came down a couple years ago, which in short basically says that an employee, if they sign a non-compete, must be employed for 2 years before the non-compete is effective if the employment is the consideration for the agreement. Basically what's happened with regard to that is, number one, we recommend that folks use other consideration when you sign Illinois employees to agreements. But the point here in our slide and what we want to convey is that there have been some decisions in 17 where the federal courts have not necessarily followed Fifield. So as you can see, there's a Stericycle case and the Apex case. Those are two cases where you get essentially some different results. And then you have the Fifield case was the first the state court, first appellate district, and there have been other opinions different than Fifield, but it's something that you should just be aware of, that the federal court has not followed Fifield, even though Illinois law is being applied. If you want to, of course, learn more information and have just a desktop reference in front of you, we have our highly anticipated and always timely, our new 50-state desktop reference, which is a 50-state survey with regard to non-competes and trade secret law. And we've been putting this out for a few years. If you're on our mailing list, then you probably would have received it already in electronic format. We also have hard copies. And if you would like one, you can certainly email us and you can get this. It's just a terrific starting point to understand what's going on. And as I said, it's very timely. We constantly update this every year or so. So it's pretty fresh information and very useful. The next thing I want to talk to you about is forum selection clauses, not only because there's been a lot of law and things occurring in the area, but also because, quite frankly, our lawyers, including the three on the call here, we've been extremely active in this area and literally making law in this area across the country. So it's something that we know very well, and certainly it's something to be aware of, because it's always a tough decision for practitioners and certainly in-house counsel in advising their corporate clients. What do you do with an agreement? What choice of law do we use? What venue should we use? And what are the ups and downs? So basically, California passed in the past year a labor code change, which essentially restrains the ability of employers to use form selection clauses as well as using choice of law clauses. And there's a safe harbor for that where if the employee consults with an attorney, is individually represented, and decides to waive or essentially accept the employer's choice of law and venue provision, that's okay as long as they did it in consultation with counsel. You know, that's something to be aware of, and it refers to agreements that have been entered into after its enactment in early 17. With regard to the federal courts have a little dichotomy here in that the federal courts in California have continued to enforce forum selection clauses, and there's about 8-9 cases at the district court level in California that have all in one form or another upheld venue provisions, whether to dismiss a deck action that's brought or to transfer it to the selected venue in an agreement, transfer the case. There are a number of cases that have enforced venue provisions, so that's important to know. The other thing, of course, is there's some cases that have dealt with these issues, and you can see here, if you want to look at them, the Mechanic Square case as well as the MOSIPAC case, and you get some decisions that uphold the venue provisions and some that don't. But as we said, the federal courts are more receptive to upholding venue selection clauses. We have a handful of cases in the state courts, but in any event, the federal courts are definitely in a different place on this issue than the state courts are in California. The other thing that you should be aware of is the Third Circuit came down with an opinion enforcing venue provisions. It was as a result of a writ of mandamus taken from the New Jersey District Court brought to the Third Circuit after the District Court had transferred a case with numerous sales representatives that had signed form selection agreements, and they transferred the case to California, which was not the form selected. A writ of mandamus was taken. The Third Circuit came down with a writ keeping all of the sales representatives in New Jersey, so essentially clawing the case back from California with regard to all the sales reps that had signed agreements. They essentially came up with a four-part test in order to assess the situation, and all of this is meant to uphold the Supreme Court decision in December of 13, the Atlantic Marine decision, which in short says venue provisions will be upheld absent exceptional circumstances. And we, of course, know this case very well because we were the counsel of record in it and we're the ones who successfully obtained the writ. I will say there's a cert petition that's been filed now on this, and we'll see how that goes. But an interesting decision, interesting reading. So I will turn things over now to Josh, who will regale you with issues regarding social media and solicitation issues. Josh?
Thanks, Mike. And for those who are waiting for the CLE code, it is SS, as in Cypher Shaw, 1051. That's SS 1051. For the next sections, I'm going to briefly touch upon issues regarding social media solicitations and computer fraud law, just briefly so we can ensure that we're able to cover the ABA ethics opinion regarding protecting confidential information. So what we've seen is courts are continuing to struggle and vary regarding the interpretations of what constitutes solicitation or similar solicitation activities with respect to analyzing restrictive covenant agreements, and particularly employee and customer non-solicits. There's two cases that we've pulled from this past year that had somewhat different facts, but the courts did have different decisions. In the first case, it was a court of appeal from Illinois. In that case, Bankers Life, they sell insurance and financial products, had a two-year customer and employee non-solicit agreement with an employee that was limited to the territory that that employee regularly serviced. The former employee left, joined a competitor, and the dispute arose when that employee sent essentially an email blast through LinkedIn, where he messaged all of his email contacts to connect with him. So it was essentially a mass professional friend request. One of the issues that the former employer had was that some of the individuals who received that LinkedIn request were current coworkers who the employer argued were covered by that employee non-solicit. So the company, Bankers Life, brought action against the former employee, claiming a violation of the non-solicitation clause. The employer specifically argued that, or the employee argued in his defense that he actually didn't do anything wrong. He didn't. It wasn't actually a solicitation because he never sent any direct messages to these employees. Instead, it was just a generic email blast that he was asking essentially everyone to connect with him on LinkedIn. The trial court agreed with the former employee and granted summary judgment in his favor, and the Court of Appeal ultimately affirmed. The court looked at other cases with similar circumstances, similar facts regarding solicitations on social media, and really focused on the content and the substance of those solicitation communications. And the court found that this generic blast was really more similar to a generic announcement. It didn't necessarily constitute a solicitation because it was generic and really had no discussion of either the plaintiff, former employer, or even the new company. One of the things that the former employer highlighted was that in this email blast, it also had a request not only to connect with this former employee, but said that you can click his profile and then see potential new job postings with his new employer. But the court did not find that significant and found that it was more of a generic email and did not rise to the level of a solicitation. The other case noted below, Mobile Mini, had a somewhat different result. It also involved communications on LinkedIn. In this case, Mobile Mini, who was in the portable storage industry, they provided these portable storage pods and storage solutions, also had a employee and customer non-solicitation agreement with their employee. She left, joined a new competitor, and then started posting on her LinkedIn, which she called were status updates. The first update she posted had pictures of the products, the storage containers with her new employer, and had a post. It was a short one paragraph that essentially said, I'm excited to join my new team. These are the products and services we offer. We also offer consistent rental rates. But then, which was important, was she said, give me a call today for a quote. And then there was a second post that also said, call me today for a quote, let's connect, and the former employee provided her specific telephone number. The former employer, Mobile Mini, moved for a preliminary injunction, arguing that those communications, those posts on LinkedIn, violated the non-solicitation agreement that had with the former employee. The court agreed and granted the preliminary injunction in part. In this case, the court found that these posts were not just generic status updates, but instead were actually blatant sales pitches. The court also noted that the purpose and intent of these status updates were to get business, to induce or entice the customers to sign up with their new employer. And the court also noted that, which was significant, is that some of those connections who saw her posts were current customers of Mobile Mini, which they'd previously serviced, and thus would be encompassed by her customer non-solicit. As part of the injunction, the court also prevented the employee from the former employee from posting any similar types of sale pitches on any other social media site where she may have Mobile Mini customers. But the court was aware not to have a complete blanket-wide restriction on social media activity and did acknowledge that she could post regular status updates, provided she did not violate the terms of her restrictive covenant agreement. One thing to note with these cases is they're always going to vary. We continue to see different decisions, largely based on the different facts of each case, the different technology or social media sites involved, but just across the different jurisdictions, we can continue to see a different analysis and different interpretations. More and more states are passing social media laws to protect privacy of both workers, potential job candidates, and then also students. Vermont was one of the latest states to get on board and pass their new social media privacy law, which we've provided a basic breakdown of what's prohibited and what's allowed. A lot of these states that have passed similar types of social media privacy legislation have somewhat similar protections, similar restrictions, although the specific details of what's allowed and prohibited do vary. To help with that, we have a social media privacy legislation desktop reference that we update every year, and so that will be accessible to see not only Vermont's new requirements, but also the various other states that have implemented some type of similar legislation. One of the notable things that happened with respect to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act this year actually may be what didn't happen. There were two cases that came out of the Ninth Circuit that have been closely followed, the NOSAL and the Power Ventures case, that were up, had petitioned the Supreme Court for review, but this past fall the Supreme Court declined to review those two cases, and so those two decisions from the Ninth Circuit currently stand. To briefly go over them, NOSAL actually involved a former employee who worked for an executive search firm, Korn Ferry, and after leaving his account, his computer network access had been terminated, but allegedly he conspired with current employees who still had access to the company's network to use their passwords to get access to that information. NOSAL, he was ultimately convicted of trade secret misappropriation under the Economic Espionage Act, but also under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And just to give some background on the CFAA, it's a federal statute that not only provides criminal liability for computer fraud as a federal statute, but also provides a private civil cause of action when the individual either authorizes a computer without access and causes damage or exceeds their authorized access and causes damage. And NOSAL was specifically followed because the Ninth Circuit has taken somewhat of a narrow interpretation regarding when an employee or individual may exceed access that they were otherwise granted. After NOSAL was convicted, the Ninth Circuit did rule that a former employee who has access revoked and then uses a current employee's login credentials to gain network access to his former company's network would violate the CFAA. When NOSAL petitioned the Supreme Court, he asked whether a person violates a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act prohibition on accessing a computer without authorization when using someone else's credentials with that user's permission. Whether that violated the CFAA after the owner had expressly revoked that first person's initial access rights. But in denying cert, the court effectively killed the petitioner's legal challenge to his conviction in that long-running case. The takeaway is that the denial of cert leaves further development of the scope of the CFAA in the hands of the lower courts. Ultimately, it's not clear whether the statements in the NOSAL decision articulate a workable test for criminal liability that does not place large swaths of public in potential legal jeopardy, but it's going to remain to be seen how lower courts will continue to interpret the CFAA and apply NOSAL and its peers in cases with less fraught in the facts of that case. Power Ventures is somewhat different in that it did not involve a former employee who accessed their former employer's computer network and computers, but instead it involved digital scraping or when the ability to access or download information from a website. That case has potentially important implications for the ways that businesses create, store, and monetize data through computers and web-based applications. In that case, what NOSAL did was that essentially aggregated social media information from people's different social media accounts and provided it in this one consolidated single platform. But Facebook had a dispute with that and brought action back in 2008 because it thought that that violated the CFAA after Facebook had attempted to revoke Power Ventures access from doing that type of conduct. What Power Ventures had argued was that they had actually obtained permission from each Facebook user that was using its service to access and essentially download and then import their social media account information into that portal. But what Facebook did after realizing what was going on, sent a cease and desist letter to Power Ventures, essentially revoking their access to the site, and then also implemented some technological barriers to prevent access from Power Ventures' purported IP sites. And so when analyzing the what is that conduct violated the CFAA as Power Ventures had continued to essentially allegedly circumvented those technological barriers and continued to scrape the data, the court noted that the Power Ventures users arguably gave Power Ventures permission to use the Facebook computers and then to further use it to disseminate messages to other Facebook contacts and get them to join the Power Ventures service. But importantly, the court found that because that the cease and desist letters by Facebook expressly rescinded that permission granted by the Facebook users and put Power Ventures on notice that it was no longer authorized to access Facebook computers, that essentially could violate the CFAA. The court also noted that there was allegedly some discovery that revealed that Power Ventures had purportedly learned of these IP blocks and technological barriers to prevent that further data scraping, but Power Ventures continued to access and implement some other measures to get around those blocks. And so ultimately, the Court of Appeal holds that while a violation of a terms of terms of use of a website without more may not be the basis for liability under the CFAA, but a commercial entity that accesses a public website after permission has been explicitly revoked could be civilly liable under the CFAA. So those two decisions are currently standing. I know there are some related pending decisions in the district courts in the Ninth Circuit regarding data scraping and other technological measures similar to Power Ventures, but as of right now, with the Supreme Court's denial for the petitions or declining to review those two Ninth Circuit decisions, those opinions are currently going to stand. And so lastly, the ABA released a formal ethics opinion last spring, and it was important because it stressed that lawyers must make reasonable efforts to prevent the unauthorized or inadvertent access to confidential information relating to the representation of their clients. The ABA recognized that in this age of constant cybersecurity threats, law firms have become a target for hackers, mainly for two reasons. One, the law firms are obtaining, storing, and using this highly sensitive information about their clients, while at times maybe using safeguards to shield that information that may be inferior to those deployed by the client. And then second, the ABA noted that the information in the law firm's possession is more likely to be of interest to the hackers because it's going to be less voluminous than that would be held by the client, and essentially is you have this condensed, reduced amount of highly valuable information. The ethics opinion further recognized that while the model rules of professional conduct do not impose greater or different duties of confidentiality based upon the method by which a lawyer communicates with his or her client, that the electronic communications still involve risks that are constantly changing. And so in examining the applicable model rules to explain what factors constitute reasonable efforts when using technology to communicate with clients, the opinion, which was notable, specifically mentioned trade secret lawyers, noting that since they handle client matters involving proprietary information, that may present a higher risk of data theft. And so trade secret lawyers must, but on a case-by-case basis, analyze how they communicate electronically about client matters and particularly strong protective measures such as encryption, which may be warranted in some circumstances. There are also a list of five non-exclusive factors to examine when reasonable efforts of determination are being made. One, the sensitivity of the information. Two, the likelihood of disclosure if additional safeguards are not employed. Three, the cost of employing additional safeguards. Four, the difficulty of employing the safeguards. And then lastly, the extent to which the safeguards adversely affect the lawyer's ability to represent clients, for example, by making a device or an important piece of software excessively difficult to use. And so when making these reasonable efforts to safeguard electronic communications and storage, Model Rule 1.1 may require the lawyer to obtain informed consent from the client regarding whether to use the enhanced security measures, the costs involved, and the impact of those costs on the expense of the representation, where a non-standard and not easily available or affordable security methods may be required or requested by the client. The opinion also stresses that reasonable efforts might require just avoiding the use of electronic communication methods or any other technology to communicate with the client altogether. But the key takeaway from this opinion is that it seems to make clear that lawyers must have this open exchange of communication with clients about the security measures the firm is taking to safeguard the client's confidential and sensitive information. They must recognize that the determination of whether they are making reasonable efforts in enhancing the cybersecurity is it's going to be a fact-based analysis and made on a case-by-case basis. So there may not be an ability for it just to be uniformly employed. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Robert and Mike. If you wanted to get some updates, stay up to date on these latest developments, we do have our trade secrets blog, which discusses some of the cases we discussed today.
Thanks, Josh. So we're delighted to announce that we're going to continue our webinar series this year. We should have programming anywhere between 6 to 9 programs this year on various hot topics on trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud law. So feel free to look out to our blog or our mailing list to get announcements on our next webinar programming. And as we announced, we will be releasing our Defend Trade Secrets Acts guide in February, and we'll also be distributing our year in review summary that highlights our key blogs on computer fraud law and trade secret non-compete law, and that should be coming out in February as well. With that, I'd like to thank you for your time, and feel free to reach out to Mike, myself, or Josh if you have any follow-up questions or concerns. Have a wonderful day.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.